The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. Five, three, two, one.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program. Great to be back after our July 4th holiday weekend. I hope everybody had a great holiday and really enjoyed it. And it's good to be back live on the Space Show, and especially good to be back with our guest tonight. This is his first time on the show, but he's a good friend, and I'm really looking forward to this program. So let me run through the announcements. For those of you who would like to call in and talk with our guest, who I will introduce shortly, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let the phone ring. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Remember, I do hold callers over the break, and in addition, I answer the phone during the break. So don't let an upcoming break stop you from using our toll-free telephone line. And email, for those of you not using the phones for whatever reason, is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And that is also our website, thespaceshow.com. So check it out. And we do have a website detailed newsletter. You'll see it over in the sort of the center of the page, center of the homepage, over toward the right side. The upcoming show menu on the far right side, scroll down. When you see shows there for the coming week, you can already start putting comments there even before the show airs. And I will be able to read those comments during the live show. And, of course, you can use it during the live show as a way to communicate comments and questions as well. And that is our blog once we go to archive. If you scroll down a little further, there are the listener voices that were perks taken by several listeners from the Indiegogo plan to build the new website. So listen to the messages. You know, a lot of you who took that perk have not sent in your message yet, and I keep reminding you. So you paid for it. You ought to use it. We want to hear your message. So if you're one of those people who mysteriously for the first half of the year has not taken advantage of your Indiegogo perk, you need to get a hold of me, drspace at thespaceshow.com, and let's do it. There is also a menu in the upper left side, and there are links to other websites, and our Cafe Press Logoware store is there and fully functioning with our new logo and lots of new products. And that's in the support menu in the upper left-hand corner. So check that one out as well. And then the old blog that we used to use is the Space Show message board for important messages, and that's in the middle of the homepage as well. So if you tune in and something's wrong with the show, like a couple of weeks ago we didn't have electrical power, but I was able to post a message there to tell you why there was no show that Sunday. So check it, and there'll only be a message there when there's something really important and timely to communicate to all of you. So let's see. You can subscribe to our email newsletter as well. That goes out at 6 a.m. California time Monday morning. Very short, guaranteed it won't clutter up your inbox. And I need your email address if you want to subscribe to that. Everything we do is archived, so you can easily listen right off of our website. Or if you have a high-speed internet connection, it takes you maybe 45 seconds to a minute to download our programs. They are around 25 megabytes each. And then I've already mentioned our Space Show store in the support menu. And then remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we exist because many of you do financially support the show. We appreciate very much your support. It keeps us on the air. And I am not exaggerating. We could not be doing this program were it not for those of you who help us by donating to the program. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction since we are a 501c3 nonprofit. If you are a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction. We're a California public benefit corporation. Check us out at 1onegiantleapfoundation.org or email me for more information, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please remember we're copyrighted and trademarked, and you do have permission to share our shows on the internet. You can actually share a full show, although 25 megabytes is a little bit hard to mail through email, but you can send people the URL. There are a couple of rules about this. Don't do anything commercial with our show. Don't edit them. Don't put clips or cuts up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. Our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our spaceshow.com website pages and our parents' website pages, onegiantleapfoundation.org. Please read it. If you have any questions, if you're just dying to use an edit or a cut or a clip from a space show program, email me and ask permission, and let's see if we can work it out. Podcasting is over there at gigadial.net. We thank Andrew for that service. And we are in iTunes and elsewhere on the net. If you have any questions about podcasting, email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then that brings me to sponsors, and we do have new sponsors given our new website. And as I keep saying, do click on the banner ads going across our homepage from time to time. Without those sponsors, we would not be doing this program. The first segment of our show tonight is brought to you by Integrated Space Analytics, and they have the Integrated Space Plan, which is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. Their website is thespaceplan.com, and there you can join discussions, get updates, and participate in interactive features. You can also buy a full-color poster of the plan. It comes in one of two sizes. It's a useful and inspiring tool that should be on the wall of everyone who is serious about space development. Again, check them out at thespaceplan, all one word, .com. And also sponsored for this first half, Orbital ATK, a global leader in aerospace and defense technology, the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And we congratulate them on their recent static booster test, which went very, very well. And that brings me to tonight's program, and I'm very happy to introduce to all of you Dr. Joe Bossi, and he is an assistant professor of arts and sciences at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and he is also an online adjunct lecturer at the National Securities Institute at the University of Texas El Paso campus. He completed his PhD in the history of science at UC Santa Barbara in June 2009. His specialty is in the history of modern U.S. science and technology. He was a senior project engineer with the Aerospace Corporation, supporting national security space efforts at Vandenberg from 2009 to 2010. During his PhD program, Joe was a Guggenheim pre-doctoral fellow in space history at the National Air and Space Museum, and that's at the Smithsonian. His recent book, which we're talking about tonight, A Scientific Peak, How Boulder Became a World Center for Space and Atmospheric Science, recently was selected as one of the best books in atmospheric sciences for 2015 in the history category by the Atmospheric Sciences Librarians International. He's a retired U.S. Air Force officer with 26 years of active duty. At various points in his military career, he served as director of the Joint Typhoon Warning Center, that's in Guam, professor of strategic studies at a DOD college, headquarters, U.S. Air Force action officer and program element manager, chief of acquisition meteorology office at Air Force Space Systems Division and the Assistant Professor of Physics at the Air Force Academy. And then after retirement from active service, he served as a space policy analyst in the Office of the Secretary of Defense while working for the Aerospace Corporation. There's more to his bio. It is on the Space Show website. And rather than continuing to read about him, let's talk to him, and perhaps he can read us a few passages from his really cool book on a very cool topic. For those of you that have been to Boulder, Colorado, you might have seen what he's talking about up on top of the hill. I believe it's facing the Flatirons, but Joe can correct me if I'm wrong with that. And, of course, the football stadium, for those of you that are into sports, is probably in back of you if you're facing over toward the mountains. Joe, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
Thanks, David. It's really great to be on the show. You know, I've been a longtime listener. It's helped me get through my PhD program when I was going through that at UC Santa Barbara. Gave me something different to think about other than coursework and writing. And so you and I have talked about this, and now I'm glad to say my book is out and we actually have something to talk about. In terms of congratulations to you on this great program and coming up on 3,000, I guess, pretty soon.
Pretty soon, absolutely. Pretty soon.
And then congratulations to the folks down at Caltech, not too far from where I'm sitting in Lompoc, California, put that spacecraft Juno into orbit around Jupiter yesterday. Quite an achievement.
Absolutely. I was actually watching it you didn't get to see it, obviously, but you saw the news updates and you heard them talking about it in the control room. And, you know, it's pretty exciting, and it went off like clockwork, didn't it? It was pretty amazing. I wish my Toyota worked as well.
I understand that. Well, for a person that's spent his whole career in and close to space, it's always eye-watering to see these kind of events actually happen. And also as a taxpayer, is $1-something billion there, but I'm sure the benefits will be worth the cost.
Say, did I get it right? Does the Institute in Boulder face the Flatirons?
Well, yeah, actually it's up on a mesa, and the institute we're talking about is the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which I go into detail in my book, how that got to be in Boulder. And as you know, David, having read the book, it's a story. But that is just one of many things in Boulder. The story is, how do you go from a scientific Siberia, as one scientist called Boulder in the late 40s, to what another scientist called Astro Boulder by the 1960s. And that's what my book is about. So NCAR actually is the end cap of my book. I stop in 1960 with the creation of NCAR up there on the mesa right next to the iconic Flatirons that sit above Boulder. And by the way, if you go to Boulder, David, you'll see that is the only building above 5,800 feet above ground level, above sea level. And that is intentional. That was a one-time exception to put a building up there so as not to ruin the view of the Flatirons and the mountains.
You're saying NCAR? I'm not picking that up correctly.
Yeah, NCAR is the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And that is run by UCAR, which is the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, which is what you would call a federally funded research and development center funded by the National Science Foundation. And so it was the first and still is a premier institution for studying atmospheric physics, atmospheric dynamics, modeling. So it is a happening place in the world of atmospheric science. So it was a big part of my story of how that got to Boulder, basically in the middle of nowhere in the 1950s.
Okay, so before you get really going, any relationship to the University of Colorado Boulder and to Southwest Research Institute?
Yes. Well, there are other institutions. The book is not just about NCAR. It's about how, as you mentioned at the beginning, David, how do all these organizations wind up in Colorado, especially in 1950s when it was harder to travel around, And how do you get this conglomeration of so many like related organizations all dealing with some aspect of the sun or the earth or the sun-earth connection? And so Southwest Research is one institution that comes along later, but the University of Colorado is a big part of the story. One of the reasons that Boulder develops as it does is because the University of Colorado is there, and it's been there since 1876, I think. So that is a part of the story. SWRI is a later part of the story. Ball Aerospace, which I'm sure many of your listeners know is in Boulder, is a little bit later after the period I discuss, which is kind of the early 60s. I actually had a chapter on Ball Aerospace, but my advisor wanted to trim it down and focus more on the science stuff. So there's lots of things in Boulder. There's the National Institute of Science and Technology. There's many NOAA labs, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. There's the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics. There's LASP, the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics. And we could go on for the next hour listing all the institutions that are there in Boulder. So my chore, actually my PhD dissertation, David, was to explain in some detail how did all that happen.
So how did that happen? So in the 50s, you know, transportation and interstate highways and air travel was not really that
right.
developed, and plus the fact the roads between Denver and Boulder sucked. So,
right. That is true.
You know,
just that one road, and there was nothing between Denver and Boulder. So, yeah, so that's an interesting intellectual question. How does this small, let's call it, you know, foothills mountain town.
College town.
Which was just a college town and not a very distinguished college at the time. An administrator called his university a middling state college. How does this kind of out-of-the-way location become Astro Boulder? And so the story really begins much earlier in the late 1930s, early 1940s. And an important part of the story, David, is Boulder starts in the world of big science, modern science, big science, as a colony of Harvard. That's the best way to say it. And so what happens? Donald Menzel, who was an astronomer at Harvard, develops what's called a coronagraph. A coronagraph is an instrument that you block out the sun, the disk of the sun, so you can see the atmosphere of the sun, and was invented by a Frenchman named Bernard Leot. Anyway, Menzel decides that he's going to put a coronagraph in Colorado. Why does he decide Colorado? Because he's from Leadville, Colorado. And Menzel knows the skies are good for solar observing in Colorado. Simple as that. David, people often ask me when I give talks and whatnot, is there some sort of magic, overriding, mystical reason, meta-narrative, to use the jargon, on why all this happened? And it's because Donald Menzel, Harvard astronomer, was from Leadville, Colorado. That is the genesis of all of this.
Now, I've been to Leadville many times.
Right.
So.
And behind Leadville, there's an area called Climax, Colorado,
right.
with a mine. And here's the important turn here. Menzel sends his graduate student named Walter Orr Roberts, who's a key character, character in my book. And he sends him to Colorado to set up the first coronagraph in Colorado, actually in the northern hemisphere, maybe western hemisphere. And so Walt Roberts, graduate student, goes up with his wife to live in Climax, Colorado in 1940 and begins monitoring the sun for solar activity that he can use the data for his PhD dissertation from Harvard. Well, in 1941, something happens. U.S. enters World War II. And it is realized even before the war that solar activity, flares, prominences, things like that, can affect communications, which obviously is important to the military. So Walt Roberts gets stuck on the mountain for 5 years during World War II, providing important data to U.S. military via something. Here's another acronym, or another acronym getting set up, the Inter-Service Radio Propagation Laboratory, the IRPL, which is part of the Carnegie Institution. This is something many people don't know, but the Luftwaffe in Germany actually was doing monitoring of what we would call today space weather and the space environment. And so lots of organizations knew that solar activity, the sun-earth connection, was important for World War II military operations. So Walt Roberts is up on the mountain for 5 years. The war ends. He can't get a job back at Harvard. He got his PhD, but there's no tenure-track positions open. So he and his wife look around to where's the nearest city that has a university. And, of course, that is Boulder. So he migrates down to Boulder, and that literally is the genesis of much of the space science and atmospheric science that occurs in Boulder in the succeeding 15, 20 years.
Okay. So what, when you say he was stuck on the mountain, what mountain are we talking about?
Well, up in Climax.
Okay.
Climax, Colorado, a couple of miles outside of Leadville.
Outside.
Right.
So how does he get from there to Boulder?
Well, basically, Boulder is the nearest big city, and so he tells his mentor, Don Menzel, that he doesn't want to be living on this the mountaintop much longer. And so he looks around, and he just, drives back down to Boulder and sets up his house in Boulder, where he lives for the rest of his life, and he sets up a group called the High Altitude Observatory. So the High Altitude Observatory is based in Boulder and is a small scientific institution which will run the Climax Solar Observatory still up in the mountains. And they form a partnership. Harvard, and here comes the University of Colorado, they form a partnership to run the High Altitude Observatory based in Boulder. So that's the beginning of the University of Colorado involvement in space space weather and sun-earth connection science.
And so why did resources and government resources, why did they get put there? Because it looks to me like they had a beginning, but it wasn't really a big, heavy kind of presence. It was just a
right.
presence there. So
no,
what sparked the continued growth in the area for all of this?
Yeah, well, again, that's part of this evolving story of science in the 20th century in the U.S. Roberts is doing a lot of self-funding. And so a lot of what his effort is not government. It's actually he's scurrying around, and I know you know about this, David, to get funds to run his operation. And one of the things he does is push this sun-earth connection. Specifically, he pushes the sun-weather connection, which is, if you give me money to study the sun, I will help you better forecast Earth weather, which still to this day is questionable. But that was one of his pitches. So he had to wait, Roberts, until the Cold War really starts and he gets a little more funding from the Air Force then. And then really Sputnik in 1957 opens up the floodgates for Roberts and other activities that are going to come into Boulder. I'm sure many of your listeners know 1957 is the beginning of the International Geophysical Year, soon followed by Sputnik. And so space becomes an important aspect, studying space, studying the Sun-Earth connection becomes really important. And where is a better place to do that now than Boulder? And so Boulder becomes one of the centers of action, so to speak, of the International Geophysical Year. So all kinds of money, government money, comes pouring into Boulder in the late 50s. So you kind of see this progress, as you say. It starts off small, and then it kind of gets bigger and bigger and bigger as more and more things accrue to Boulder because of the Sun-Earth connection science. And a big thing that happens in the early 50s is the National Bureau of Standards moves what is now called the Central Radio Propagation Laboratory, which was the IRPL in World War II, sorry for all the acronyms, but to Boulder. And that's a long and complex story that I tell in my book that is very much meshed in Cold War politics of the early 1950s. So you go from HAO to the National Bureau of Standards, Central Radio Propagation Lab, to International Geophysical Year activities, to the creation of NCAR in Boulder. So that's I've reduced the whole book to about two paragraphs, but that's really the sequence there. And more, as more and more stuff goes into Boulder, more and more stuff goes into Boulder.
So you have an initial email from Jim in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he says, I'm wondering the role of personalities in all of this. I know in the early history of JPL, for example, the founding personalities were key to how JPL evolved and some of the other issues around the early days of JPL. What were the personalities like in the early days of creating this industry in Boulder?
Yeah, very important. Because the personalities are key, and I would up Jim one by saying it's not just the personalities, it's how the personalities interacted, because that's a key part of the Boulder story. You get a number of people who are really shaping astronomy in the mid-20th century American scene. And so you have Walt Roberts, you have Donald Menzel, you have Edward Condon, who is, if you know UFOs, the Condon Report.
Right.
That's the same Ed Condon. He was the head of the National Bureau of Standards in the late 40s, early 50s. So he's a fat person bringing stuff to Boulder. The one of the things I argue in my book is what is unique about this situation. And one of the things that's unique is Boulder, especially for Sun-Earth science, is not doing heavily classified work. So there's a free exchange among the scientists in Boulder. Hey, what are you working on? What are you working on? There's lots of interaction, which makes Boulder very attractive for scientists, not just American scientists, but international scientists. So Boulder in the 50s becomes one of the homes of a very famous space physicist named Sidney Chapman. And actually, Walt Roberts designates him a ambassador of Boulder. So back to Jim's question, personalities are very important. One of the things, remember at the beginning, David, I said that Boulder begins sort of as a colony of Harvard. Well, there's a rebellion in the colonies. Eventually, Walt Roberts kind of gets tired of Don Menzel telling him how to run his show. And in 1955, there's what was called at the time a divorce between Harvard and Boulder. So those personalities are very key. One scholar at the time who was on the board of directors of the HAO was reading some letters between Menzel and Roberts, and his comment was, "My God, these people hate each other." So, personalities are huge in this. Another personality who is huge is Senator Big Ed Johnson. Don't you love that name, David? And Big Ed basically was a heavyweight politician in Colorado, two-term senator, two-term governor, who was very instrumental back on the D.C. end in aiming the NBS to Colorado and to Boulder. So he's another personality that's involved. Let me say one last thing. An important aspect of Robert's personality is he was not, I say again, not an empire builder. He believed in a very distributed kind of science, which you actually see if you ever get back to Boulder and take a tour of the NCAR building. He believed that science was better off organizationally flat, so to speak, with not lots of hierarchy and with scientists doing their own thing but always interacting with each other. So he was not your classic, I'm going to build me some huge institution. He was very encouraging to bring organizations into Boulder that would work with him but that he had no control over. So Jim, you are right. This is an important part of the story, and in this case it relates very significantly to Walt Roberts' personality.
You have another question, and this is Sarah in Seattle, and she says, to what degree did the population of Boulder and, on the larger scale, Colorado, know and understand what was happening and developing in the Boulder area, and did they need to be supportive of it, or was this all going on and they were clueless?
Sarah
in Seattle, yeah.
Yeah, Sarah, that is a fantastic question, and that is one of the cores of my book. On two occasions, I guess I should say multiple cores of my book, on two occasions, Boulder citizens actively campaigned, and to my knowledge, this is unique, actively campaigned to bring science to Boulder. The first case was, I mentioned the National Bureau of Standards. Turns out there was a competition. Where are we going to put this new lab? And the Boulder citizens came up with the idea of buying land with private money and ceding that land to the U.S. government to bring in the Boulder lab. So, and they raised $80,000 of what was needed was $70,000. Remember, this is 60, 70 years ago, so we're talking, you know, a couple of million.
Yeah.
And that was successful. So Boulder citizens, through the Chamber of Commerce, actually had a drive. They called it their prosperity drive. And that if you gave money to buy this land to give to the government, you would actually be buying prosperity insurance, David and Sarah. And they actually gave out make-believe insurance policies. And the claim was for every dollar you donate to the land, you'll get $28.50 return.
How'd they figure that out?
Yeah, well, that was my next comment, David, right? I got a feeling that was, you know, off the cuff. But that was a case where the citizens of Boulder, and by the way, at that time you had maybe 10,000 people and a couple of thousand more students, actively sought to bring science, in this case the National Bureau of Standards Lab, into Boulder. And then, remember, you started off asking about the NCAR building?
Right.
All right. In 1957... the citizens of Boulder wanted to stop development above a certain level. I mentioned 5,800 feet above sea level, so as not to destroy the scenic beauty of the mountains. And no sooner was that law passed than the citizens of Boulder voted on an exemption to that law. That exemption was to build NCAR up on the mesa. So when you go to Boulder now and you scan the mountains, you'll see the only building at that level and above is the NCAR building. So there was actually a vote a plebiscite taken in town in Boulder to amend one time the Blue Line law, and it passed, I think, 3 or 4 to 1. So good question there. Twice Boulder citizens voted either with checkbooks or with a literal vote to bring science into Boulder.
Pretty amazing, because you don't find that in very widespread in other areas where centers have developed. I mean, you find pockets of people really interested, like Mojave, for example, and the amateur launch groups and stuff like that.
I think, one was 1950, one was late 50s, so about 10 years apart. I think what you see there is the realization by just plain old folks and businesses in Boulder that Boulder was becoming and was desirable to become a place to do science in general and sun-earth science in particular.
So here's another question for you. This is kind of a different take on things. Peter is in Chicago, and it looks like this is going to be an email night and not a phone number night.
Right.
I really keep pushing for phones, but, God, it's like pushing, the medicine ball uphill.
It's
1-866-LISTENER 687-7223 for those of you that don't know what a medicine ball is. I feel sorry for you, but look it up on Google. Peter says, I find it strange that you are the one writing this book and not someone from Boulder. What piqued your interest? Why you?
This was basically my PhD dissertation. Genesis was, as you've read my biography, in the Air Force, I did space weather. So I wanted to do something about space weather, the history of space weather. And as you know, David, I know you've gone through your PhD program. You kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, David? Debate, interact with your advisor.
You get manipulated. Let's just call it what it is. You get manipulated by your advisor to sort of follow their track, right?
Something that was a little more diverse than just the science of space weather, and I understand that. And we didn't get to the part of my biography, so I'll mention it, that I went to graduate school at the University of Colorado at Boulder in the early 80s. And I knew Walt Roberts, not well, but I knew him. And so my advisor, Patrick McCrae, by the way, who's written a number of great books relating to space things, he basically suggested, why don't you write something about where space weather, space science, atmospheric science is done, because that's your background. And I said, okay, that's Boulder. And that's the genesis of the dissertation, and now the book was something that had not been written extensively about. Like all scholars, and as you know, David, you build on the work of others. There were a couple of people who'd written some things about Boulder. For instance, David Spires at the University of Colorado wrote an article in Quest magazine, which I know your listeners know Quest. About Walt Roberts, so that triggered me to Walt Roberts as an interesting character to study in more detail. And there were some other things out there about Front Range science. So I said, okay, this is kind of an interesting topic to pursue. And lucky for me, Walt Roberts kept a lot of paper, and both at the University of Colorado Archives and at the UCAR NCAR Archives. But the story I want to mention, or I want to emphasize, this story is not just about Boulder. This story is about how science funding changed over a 30-year period in the U.S. from the 30s to the 60s, or early 60s. So as a result, I spent a lot of time in D.C. at the National Science Foundation Archives, at the National Archives, at the Library of Congress, National Academy of Sciences, getting that side of how science funding was shifting and how that fed into the Boulder story. So that's the answer to that question, is I went to graduate school and I thought, based on the other inputs I was getting, that this would be an interesting subject to pursue. And my advisor agreed.
Okay, a couple of things. The relationship with the famous architect I.M. Pei.
We're great, yeah.
Tell me about it, because I met him. I knew him.
And, okay. First, let me say, again, I base my work, as many scholars do, on other scholars. Bill Leslie at Johns Hopkins has written a nice paper on the actual architecture of the NCAR building. The simplest way to say it is Walt Roberts worked with I.M. Pei to put into three dimensions Walt Roberts' view of how science should work. So if you go into the NCAR building, you will see there are like almost little cells like Monte Cassino in Italy for the scientists to work in. But there are lots of open areas where scientists would come and interact, either intentionally or unintentionally. So there was a constant stream of communication between Roberts and I.M. Pei on what that building was going to look like. And so what you are seeing is a visualization of a creation of Walt Roberts' visualization of what a science center should look like. And again, it's kind of fascinating to think of it in those terms. But Walt Roberts, I'll repeat, was not an empire builder. And if you notice in the NCAR building, there's no one place where, you know, from the commanding heights, the director can look out upon the, you know, his minions sort of thing, or her minions.
Right.
That's absolutely intentional. Roberts wanted that to be, again, his idea, almost a monastery of science, if you kind of catch my drift there. And he wanted it up on that hill. And that's why he was able to work with the people in Boulder to get the blue line amended. By the way, his wife, Janet, was one of the people that helped create the blue line law in the first place. So,
what is
again,
blue line?
You see the role of personalities here. So as soon as that blue line went into effect, they created an exception, which Janet supported, as you might guess, right?
Tell them what blue line refers to.
Yeah, the blue line is the magical line, not real, at 5,800 feet above sea level that you can't build above in Boulder.
And that exists today, too.
Right. That still exists. It's never been violated or changed except one time right at the beginning for Walt Roberts' NCAR building, the I.M. Pei building you're talking about.
Okay. So, listeners, just to tell you, his book is extremely well documented with footnotes and pictures and all sorts of detail that bring it to life. But you have a wanted poster in here for Walt Roberts.
Right.
Horse theft astrology, bilking widows, snake oil sales, wanted internationally. So swindles, claim jumping, and other learned pursuits.
Exactly,
this was like P.T. Barnum would have been proud of this wanted poster.
Well, Walt Roberts... if you recall, I mentioned in passing that one of his techniques to get money when he had to kind of beat the streets to get money was to tell people, if you fund me to study the sun, we'll be able to do better weather forecasting, day-to-day weather forecasting. Even back then, that was considered questionable, and today it's still considered questionable among meteorologists. So Roberts becomes the first director of NCAR. Now, an interesting part of the story is, how does an astronomer, right, become the first director of the National Center for Atmospheric Research? I mean, astronomy and meteorology are two different subjects. Well, I go into that in my book. The short answer is that Roberts was well known as a scientific administrator, and there was a short list of people who could run scientific institutions, and Roberts had become famous enough that he was on the short list to run NCAR. So basically, I think a question I answer is, how does a meteorologist become how does an astronomer become the head of the first meteorological institute in the United States? So that's a question I kind of trace out, and it relates to Roberts' interest back to the poster that was always considered dubious by meteorologists. So, but Roberts, back to Jim's question about personality, was a very affable, for just a lack of way, a better way to say it, a nice guy. And so that poster was done during his tenure as director of NCAR on, I could never trace it exactly whether it was for a birthday or a special occasion. But anyway, it was a loving tribute to Walt Roberts and some of his pursuits. If you're looking at the book, you see he's got a prisoner number underneath him.
Oh, yeah, it looks like a real mugshot.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he was in on it. That prisoner number underneath is actually an inside astronomy joke. The first four numbers, 5303, is the coronal green line that the corona emits, wavelength, 5303 angstrom units. And the second number is the wavelength of the hydrogen alpha line that astronomers use to study the sun. So there's a little in-joke there, too.
Yeah, one that I'm sure everyone picked up on, right?
obviously, in that crowd, they would. But that was a loving tribute. There's no question. Roberts was a legend in Boulder. He was a legend in the Sun-Earth community. He was considered a force in creating modern solar science and also modern atmospheric science through being the first director of NCAR. So again, an important person, but a very different kind of personality than you often see in these kinds of important people.
Listeners, we're at the halfway point, so we're going to pause for our three-minute break and come back with part two with Dr. Bassey in a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere. And email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And our phone line, which is available, 1-866-687-7223. And we'll be back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of tonight's Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. We're talking to Dr. Joe Bassey about the history of space and atmospheric science in Boulder, Colorado. He has a great book out, which I totally recommend, A Scientific Peak, How Boulder Became a World Center for Space and Atmospheric Science. And it's readily available. It's extremely well documented. And Joe's a great storyteller, both on the Space Show tonight and also in writing, as I have read his book. We have two sponsors bringing you this program tonight, and actually AIAA, which is one of our sponsors, is where I finally got to meet Joe in person. And AIAA is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They're the largest aerospace professional society. They have over 30,000 individual members from 88 countries and 95 corporate members. They shape the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology and increasing our knowledge of the universe. And they bring the world closer together. Check them out at AIAA.org. For those of you planning to be at Space 2016 in the Long Beach area in September, make sure you let me know. I'd love to meet up with you as I am planning to be there. And then our other sponsor is Celestis, and they are the premier global leader providing Memorial spaceflight services since 1995. And they have achieved a major milestone toward the launch of their next big Memorial spaceflight, and this is going off from the Cape. Last month, the first set of ashes were integrated into the orbital testbed satellite, now undergoing final construction and testing by Surrey Satellite Facility, not far from where our friend tonight is talking about, and we may ask him about Surrey Satellite. That's one of the space businesses that has been attracted to this area, including Sierra Nevada, by the way. The satellite will orbit the Earth for at least 5 years and can be tracked on the Celestis website as well as other satellite tracking websites, joining two other Celestis spacecrafts currently orbiting the planet. The second set of ashes is going to be integrated into the satellite later this year, but there is still time to make a reservation if you have a loved one that you would like to honor in this way. Attending a Celestis Earth orbit launch at the Cape is an exciting experience. Families meet others with loved ones on board the flight, talk with astronauts and mission representatives about the mission, tour NASA Kennedy Space Center, participate in a Celestis memorial service, and view the launch. So go check them out, Celestis.com, Celestis.org. And as I say, I've been their customer with my mom and my two dogs, and they're absolutely one of the best companies and organizations I've ever worked with, and I love those people there. They what a way to do a tribute for someone who you want to honor by sending them to space. And Joe, welcome back. You know, there's a lot of space industry in and around Boulder. I mean, that's not related to atmospheric stuff. I mean, you know, it seems to have attracted a lot of industry.
Yes, and I at the end of my book, I argue, or not argue, but talk about how Boulder has become a center for space and a center for environmental issues. And I do argue that that's a logical outgrowth of the original foundation of the Sun-Earth Connection studies. Because if you think about it, Sun-Earth Connection, man, you can go in a lot of ways with that kind of science, right? You're basically
right.
Studying everything. Again, things happen in the 50s in Boulder that kind of make it very homey for science, space science, atmospheric science, and then in the 60s, environmental sciences. So, absolutely. Now, an interesting comparison and contrast, compare and contrast to Boulder, is Colorado Springs. Colorado Springs kind of grows as a military space town. So the dynamic is very different than what happens in Colorado Springs than in Boulder. Now, my book is about Boulder, not Colorado Springs, but I do address a couple paragraphs on this different dynamic. Boulder is not your classic military-industrial complex, for lack of a better way to say it, kind of town. Where Colorado Springs fits a little bit more into that mold of Cold War military-industrial complex, what one scholar, Ann Marcusin, calls the Gun Belt. So Boulder is decidedly not part of the Gun Belt, as scholars refer to it.
Yeah, if for anyone who's been to Boulder, you get that sense real quickly.
Is that right? Now, can I give you a story of how Boulder almost didn't happen?
Sure.
It's covered in my book. Remember I suggested or I talk about how Boulder began as a colony of Harvard? Well, in 1947, beginning of the Cold War, the U.S. Air Force Cambridge Research Lab at Hanscom Air Force Base in Massachusetts toddles over to Harvard and asks Don Menzel to build a solar observatory for him in New Mexico, for them in New Mexico. Reason being to be close to the V-2 launches at White Sands. And so Menzel, interested in that Air Force money, decides to build what we now know as Sunspot, a New Mexico solar telescope. At that time, Menzel's boss, a famous astronomer named Harlow Shapley, says, why do we need two solar observatories in Colorado and New Mexico? Why don't we just close Colorado and move everybody to this big new observatory in New Mexico? And here's where Roberts comes in. Roberts, remember, had just come off a mountain for 5 years. He and his wife were not ready to go up another mountain and basically told Harlow Shapley, we're not going to do that. And sorry, but not interested. And some other astronomers did work for High Altitude Observatory said the same thing. And so if Roberts had said, sure, we'll go up another mountain, it's conceivable a lot of the Sun-Earth foundation of Boulder would have never evolved. So that's one of these, what we call in the history profession, counterfactuals, what-ifs. So that's an interesting what-if I talk about in my book.
Dr. Doug in Southern California posted a comment with a cartoon on the blog, given my medicine ball comment. So, listeners, if you're interested, you can go check that out. He also sent in a note, and he said, is there anything to say about Zubrin and Frontier Astronautics? Now, they're in the space business, and Zubrin's Mars Society is really close by. Also, there's a lot of other rocket companies there. I mean, we talked about that a little bit, but
sure.
It sure spread into the entrepreneurial and space advocate world.
Well, again, it became a home for all things based on the Sun-Earth connection, which is a lot of science, right?
Uh-huh.
And so, Ball kind of started that ball rolling. That was a joke, David. But basically, a lot of stuff starts accruing into Boulder, especially in the 60s and 70s. We mentioned I went to University of Colorado at Boulder in the early 80s. One of my compatriots in graduate school was Chris McKay, and one of the founders of the Mars Society. So I was around at the beginning of the Mars Society. I was too busy surviving graduate school to get too involved, but I was familiar with that, and it's all a very logical outcome of this sequence I've been trying to at least flesh out tonight.
An active area. Listeners, we'll take more of your emails, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and the phone line is available, and maybe some of you have taken a tour through the area that Joe is talking about. If you have gone to Boulder and gone hiking, some of the paths that go into the Flatirons, you can also walk up to the top of the mesa to where the center is, and
sure.
If you're game for that, it's not a very challenging hike, but it is there.
David, you inadvertently hit on a sad note.
Okay.
Walt Roberts, who was so influential in making Boulder what it is today, is all but forgotten. And one of the few remnants of his legacy is one of those hiking trails is the Walter or Roberts hiking trail.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and except for a plaque on the NCAR building when you go walking in up the steps, he is all but forgotten. And so I think one of the reasons historians do what they do is to kind of for lack of a better way to put it, resurrect people from the from obscurity, and try to, you know, position them and make them known again for what they did do, their accomplishments.
Why do you think he was forgotten?
Well, I think most people in history are forgotten. I mean, if you, even important people at the time, if you think of, look at American history. I mean, how many people could you actually name in American history? Dozens of millions, hundreds of millions of Americans. So people get overcome reputations and things by the seas of time, right?
I guess so.
And science, I'm a trained scientist besides being a trained historian, so I might get some flack for this, but scientists tend not to be very backward-looking, and you can understand that, right?
Right.
They're always looking at what's now, what's in the future. So the term, another jargon, is ahistorical. Scientists tend to be ahistorical. They're worrying about the next discovery, the next experiment, the next proposal they have to put in. They're not that interested in looking back to how we got here.
Unlike a politician, all they want is a legacy to be remembered, right?
Well, some do, but again, an interesting thing of Walt Roberts was I didn't get that vibe at all. I mean, from his papers, and it was a very self-effacing. I mean, you saw the poster, right? I mean, he let that be done. He great sense of humor, not imperious in any way, an interesting guy. I mean, he had his flaws and his issues, but a fascinating man, no question.
Todd is in San Diego, your area.
I'm in Lompoc now. I moved.
Oh, you moved back up.
Yeah, next to Vandenberg Air Force Base.
By the way, are you going to be at the AIAA in Long Beach?
Not planning on it, David.
Okay. All right, Todd is in San Diego, and he said, how readily did Boulder get accepted by the scientific community as a center of activity?
Again, one of the phenomenon that I point out in my book is that it goes from scientific Siberia to astro Boulder in less than 15 years. So as a scholar, if I may pretentiously claim that, that is a stunning thing. And it wasn't done by a bunch of people sitting in a room saying, we're going to do this. I mean, it happened organically, to use a buzzword today. So to me, it's a phenomenon worth explaining, and I hope I explain it. And a key to that explanation is that it became a center for sun-earth science, and that sun-earth science had sort of tendrils that could get into other areas of science and make other areas of science want to be in Boulder, you know, other people doing science. And so Boulder explodes. My book is just about space and atmospheric science, as you pointed out. There's lots of other science that goes on in Boulder, and there's industry to boot, which all began in the 50s.
A lot of engineering goes on in and around.
Absolutely. IBM moved a big plant there in the early 60s. That was one of the big, you know, industrial things to go on in Boulder. But at its heart, I think Boulder is a place for the sun-earth connection. And I've never quite explained that, but, you know, there's a sun out there, there's the earth here, 93 million miles apart, but they're not disconnected. They're connected through magnetic fields, through particle emanations coming from the sun. So that itself is a scientific realm, the sun-earth connection. And Roberts was a key investigator in the sun-earth connection. And it really, I think, lays a lot of the foundation of Boulder as a place to do science, is this sun-earth connection study.
Linda's in Boston and sent in an email. And again, I'll give out the phone number, listeners. 1-866. I keep trying. 1-866-687-7223. Linda says, "Is Boulder, or is there any place in Colorado, an Do you hear some music playing?
No. Unfortunately, that's my father-in-law's clock, and I can't escape it without getting away from the base station.
Okay, so
I apologize.
If we hear it going cuckoo all of a sudden, we'll know it's not related to the show.
Yeah.
Okay, so Linda is in Boston and said, is there any place in Boulder or in Colorado in general where there is an astronomical observatory?
A good question. I'm not an astronomer today, so I don't really know everything about what's going on in Colorado.
I don't think there are any major observatories. I think there's a student one at the University of Colorado, but it's not major.
Yeah, that's the Summers Bosch Observatory. But that's a student, low-end, for lack of a better way to say it. It's not a super major observatory like exists in Hawaii or down in Chile, those places.
Yeah, so, I don't think there is in Colorado either.
No, and that's an interesting question on why there isn't, but I didn't go there.
If it isn't around Boulder, there'd probably be light pollution today, so you wouldn't see that happening.
Very good. Yeah, very good. And I think actually they're even on higher mountains in Hawaii and South America.
Also in Arizona, although light pollution is creeping up and shortening the life expectancy of observatories in and around Tucson.
Sure. David, can I just quickly discuss what we talked about, explaining what part of Embry-Riddle I'm at?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Dave and I were talking on the break. When people say Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, they tend to think of Daytona Beach or maybe Prescott, Arizona campuses. I'm on the worldwide campus. So we actually have 100-plus centers around the world, often at U.S. or near U.S. military installations. And we also have a presence online, a huge presence online. And you can get a whole host of degrees from us, either at one of the centers or a combination of at the centers or online. And we've been voted by U.S. News, I guess, as the number one online university. So I'm pretty sure that's right, but don't hold me to it. But we have a huge distance learning program. And that's the part I'm with. So one of the oddities is I hardly ever meet my colleagues. Our department meetings are either by Skype or over the phone. I have colleagues in my department in Italy and all over the United States. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Interesting. I teach that way at the University of North Dakota, but fortunately I don't have to have department meetings.
Well, I'm a full-time faculty. Actually, I'm going to half-time starting this academic year so I can do more research and writing. But that's the way it works. So that's why I can move easily from San Diego to Lompoc and back. It's not an issue.
As long as you have a good internet connection.
As long as I've got a good internet connection. Exactly, David.
What in your research really surprised you, just caught you totally off guard, just came at you from out of left field? What was there anything like that?
I would say back to Walt Roberts' story of, one, how much he had to hustle to get funding before Sputnik 1957. He was a scientific entrepreneur, not in the sense of the way Elon Musk is an entrepreneur, but in the sense of having to really run around to lots of places to get small pots of money to keep his operation going. So that was a surprise. And again, that was part of his sun weather study or pitch that is considered dubious. But it actually worked for him. And that was surprising, too. He got companies like sugar mills, distilleries, airline companies to fund his solar research. So that was surprising to me. I even found one company in his files, believe it or not, a camping equipment company that wanted to buy him out the observatory and have the observatory as a subunit of this camping company. He did not take up that offer. But it was interesting to see before Sputnik how much scientists had to run around to get funding for their work.
What happened after Sputnik? That all changed?
To use Roberts's words, Sputnik saved us, because he was really starting to go under at high altitude observatory. And after Sputnik, there was a tremendous influx of government money. There was the missile gap, there was the education, but there was also the education gap, there was the science gap. I even found one document that talks about the forecast gap with the Soviet Union, that they would forecast weather better than us, and therefore we couldn't let that happen. And that was one of the reasons NCAR was created, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, was to help defeat the forecast gap with the Soviet Union.
Was that a real gap, or was that an imaginary?
I'm not an expert in Soviet science, so I could not tell you.
Interesting. I hadn't heard about a forecast gap before.
Well, it also shows how, again, entrepreneurial scientists were. In my business, in the history of science, there's lots of literature about how the military manipulated science. And from my studies, I think it was a two-way street, David. I think scientists were tapping into the military with glee, and it was a symbiotic relationship. There may have been some disciplines where the military was more authoritative than other disciplines, but I once talked to a scientist who now has passed, an older space physicist. I asked him this question about, do you feel the military was manipulating your science? And he laughed and said, if anything, we were manipulating them. So that's all I can say.
Do you think if you walk down the streets of Boulder today and you ask 10 people who Walt Roberts was, all 10 would tell you?
I would say maybe one.
So he is really forgotten.
Oh, yeah, except for the kind of people who have a historical interest or people who knew him. He died in 92, so it wasn't that long ago that he was around. But in general, he is basically forgotten, as are Donald Menzel and Edward Condon and Senator Big Ed Johnson, who was important in developing Colorado using his political clout in the 50s. A sidebar to Senator Big Ed Johnson, what he's known for is he condemned Ingrid Bergman on the floor of the U.S. Senate when she dumped her husband for Carlo Ponti, I'm not sure, the Italian director.
So, listeners, he's got great pictures. So you have one picture that I marked to ask you about. So is Janet Roberts his wife or daughter?
No, his wife.
And he's
in the car up the mountain?
Yeah, so he's driving the car, and he's got the wife pushing it up the mountain.
But back to personalities. They were both very pleasant people. I assume that picture was staged, that he took the picture. And it was just meant to be a fun thing. But it's a cute picture when I give talks on this, I call that, Life of an Astronomer's Wife around 1940.
Yeah, it looks like a late 30s or 40s World War II vintage type of car.
That is 1940. When they are heading into the mountains of Colorado to set up the observatory that he's going to use for his PhD dissertation work, which he actually got in 1943 during the war, and it was actually born classified. but was declassified right at the end of the war.
You know what kind of car that was?
No, sorry. It's in his document somewhere, but I didn't take note of that.
Now, it looks like they enjoyed the winter because you got some pictures of them snow skiing in there, too.
Well, that's right. I point that out. But if you also see the picture where Janet is putting up laundry and
uh-huh.
you see the icicles on the observatory dome,
right?
They were ready to get off that mountain after 5 years. I mean, that was meant to be a year to 2 year stay. It was not meant to be, you know, on the order of 5 years, 40 to 45.
Any kids and any family that's left from them?
I believe there is, but this is not a biography of Robert, so I didn't really get into a lot of family kind
of
stuff.
So you didn't try to find them or interview them or anything like
no,
that?
No, and Robert's brother was a Navy pilot who was killed in World War II, and there's always interesting speculation about how that affected him. And because after the war, he became a very big advocate of world government and the UN.
Oh, but
and that got him in trouble, as I talk about in my book, with the McCarthy era. And he actually had a security investigation, as many scientists did back then, but he really, you know, breezed right through it. And his famous story was in his security investigation after it was over, one of the inquisitors ran down to him and asked him, did he really know Einstein? So it was a pretty straightforward thing.
Very interesting times, isn't it?
It was, and that's why, you know, I kind of consider myself a historian of the 1950s. You know, a lot was going on, a lot changed. I just gave a talk in Edmonton, Canada at a History of Science conference talking about how this older book, The Story, is a story of transitions. There's many transitions that occur in this book. Obviously, Boulder from scientific Siberia to, you know, someplace gee whiz for science. Transition of Roberts from astronomer to meteorologist. Transition of scientists having to, you know, dig the earth to find funding to government largesse, and the transition from simple science to what's called big science, you know, heavy government funding, super large institutions, you know, NASA, big science, and in the military too. So this 50s is an era of transition, which to me makes it all the more interesting as a time to study.
Harry in Denver sent in a note, and he said, having lived in Denver for only 5 years, I'm really not that familiar with what you're talking about tonight. Do you know if these facilities in Boulder offer tours to people?
I don't know the details. I'm pretty sure NCAR does. I'm not sure about the other ones. You would have to get a list or get a copy of my book. I'll say that, or find one somewhere, and look at the list of organizations.
Yeah.
I think in the first chapter I list out a bunch of the organizations: LASP, JILA, NOAA Labs. And I suspect, like NOAA, you know, is a big government organization, they might have some sort of tours that go through there. I'm fairly sure NCAR does, but you'd have to check their respective websites and see what was available.
I think years ago when I was there, there were tours, but everything's changed
right.
in recent years, so because of security and other reasons.
Right, and funding, too.
No, but you can get on the phone and call them and ask them if they offer tours,
right.
or go to their website. And
exactly.
See what they say.
And I'm fairly sure some of the bigger ones do, but you'd have to double check. I wasn't there to tour. I was there to study.
Do you think that Boulder, phrase off the cover of your book, as a world center for space and atmospheric science, is secure, or do you think that policies or something could come about shift that elsewhere or diversify it elsewhere?
No, it's not going to. Nothing will significantly change in Boulder. It is a world center for space and atmospheric science. It grew generically. It grew out of the circumstances of the early Cold War. It's what you would call an epiphenomenon of the Cold War. And actually, I would say boldly, there are no lessons to learn from my book. I mean, my book is an interesting study on what happened. But if you're looking for lessons on how to do it again, I don't think you can do it again.
No, too many unique things and people came together at the right time to create this.
Yeah, another jargon that professors use is contingent. There's lots of contingencies here that occurred will never happen again. Like, for instance, the early Cold War and Sputnik and IGY. I mean, Boulder was in a perfect position intellectually to benefit from the IGY, the International Geophysical Year, 57-58. I mean, that was not planned. That happened by accident. And it goes back right to Donald Menzel. It all started because Donald Menzel grew up in Leadville, Colorado, and there you have it.
So another story that you introduced me to that is very unique and could not be replicated was when you turned me on to the history of space and aviation at the museum in Pasadena at the Huntington Library.
Right.
That was incredibly well documented in that museum. And that was people and personalities and situations coming together in Southern California and the war and all that. You wouldn't be able to replicate it again.
No, and that excellent comparison, David. That's another place I've been interested in studying to, again, compare and contrast with Boulder. George Ellery Hale was the person that really brought science to Pasadena. So he's in some ways sort of kind of a Walt Roberts. And George Ellery Hale is one of the most significant astronomers of the 20th century and late 19th century. A solar physicist turned entrepreneur who built Mount Wilson 100-inch and then Mount Palomar after he died, but started at 200-inch. So he is from Chicago back east. He moved from Chicago. Well, I think he grew up in Boston, moved to Chicago, then went to Pasadena. He was the driving force in making Throop Caltech, Throop Technological Institute. So he is a very interesting character, like Walt Roberts, maybe even more important. So I absolutely agree. Pasadena is an interesting comparison point to Boulder.
Yeah, and that was a great experience. You introduced me to the curator of the exhibit there, and I got a lot of programs on the space show with that, including
right.
Harold Robin, which was just amazing.
Right. Yeah. That's my friend Peter Westwick.
Right.
And by the way, as we're ending up soon here, I did want to say too, I mean, I consider this a great honor and a professional highlight, to be on a program that has had many of my mentors and colleagues like Peter, like David Dvorkin at Air and Space, John Logsdon, of course, Scott Pace, you know, all friends, colleagues over my now long career. So this is a great buzz for me.
Well, and you're right up there with them. Is there a Boulder Museum that tells this story?
Apparently there will be. I gave a talk, actually a book signing, right after the book came out in November back in Boulder. And there is a move afoot to create basically a Boulder science-type museum. So I'm hoping that leads to something. And by the way, I tell people at that book signing, that was the first time in my life, David, people asked me for my autograph, not on a legal document.
So that's good. So you, I hope you gave away a lot of them.
Well, yeah, this is an academic book. So as you know, David, these are not going to be the next Tom Clancy, right? But, you know, if I sell hundreds of books, I feel like I've done something and, you know, helped preserve the history of Boulder. I did get an award, by the way, from a Boulder group for helping to preserve the history of Boulder, so that was nice. I think it's important to tell these stories. It's why historians exist, is to tell these stories, to capture policies of the past. I'm not one that says history repeats itself, but I lean more towards, I think it was Mark Twain who said, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And so I think there are things you can learn, just not real lessons, quote unquote.
We are coming up on the end of the program. What should we have talked about, or what have I forgotten, or what did you want to be sure to include?
Well, I think we covered it pretty much, David. Again, thanks for having me on. I think history is important. And I always cringe, David, when I hear people say history is boring. I don't think history is boring. I think it tells us how we got here, right?
Right.
And I think especially in the space business, it's a very interesting history to tell us how we got here. You mentioned if Boulder goes away, it would never go away. Same thing with Vandenberg here. Vandenberg is here because of physics. You know, it's 5 minutes from my house, the main gate. So it's never going to go away. So all these places have stories based on policies, on decisions made, on physics, on geography, which are interesting stories. So these places have biographies, too.
Interesting. Is there any concluding comment, any pearl of wisdom or takeaway you want to leave us with?
The only thing I would say, David, and I know you talk about this sometimes with your other guests, is if anybody wants to continue the discussion, I would be more than happy to. I'm all over the Internet with the book and with my schools. So I'd be happy to answer questions or interact with people, or you know, people know more resources I could possibly be using. I'm doing a proposal now for another book for the same publisher, American Meteorological Society. Still toying around with what I want to do, but it would have something to do with meteorology.
If listeners post comments on the blog, I will make sure you see them and send them to you.
I appreciate that, David. And hopefully, maybe we'll see you gone up and down on the 101, so be sure to let me know.
Absolutely. I mean, we might plan it, and when I come back from Long Beach, I can take the 101 up and get together with you again.
Sure.
So,
and
love to do it.
And you know, for downstream, maybe you could have me back on. I don't mean to, you know, to push on you, but we could talk more about space weather and the history of space weather, which is very fascinating and something I'm really getting into now.
Do you go see rocket launches at Lompoc?
When you can. Often there's a fog, I've gotten to see nice launches. About 10 years ago, I saw the last launch of Titan IV, and I was kind of getting weepy-eyed over that one because I had worked Titan IV 20 years before that. So that was 15 years before that, right at the beginning. So that was kind of a special launch. And you see, you know, various launches occurring here, you know, relatively routinely, not as much as the olden days. I once read in 1967 there were over 100 launches of something from Vandenberg.
Well, not now.
Not now.
I do want to come down and see an Atlas V launch one of these times. So.
Well, again, let me know, David, and you know, we'll do lunch or get a...
Do you go on the base, or do you have a place outside the base where you can see them?
No, right across the street. I live in a subdivision called Vandenberg Village.
Okay.
And there's a hill called Muffin Hill right in the middle of Vandenberg Village, and the space groupies tend to climb up there. And with binoculars or decent telescope, you can actually see the pads from there.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's given a career space guy, this is about as good as it gets, right?
Absolutely. All right, we will talk again. I like the topic of space weather. We've done programming on it, but not all that often. But it is fascinating. So we will plan that for. Probably September through the end of the year sometime.
Sure. And again, my spin would be the history of, not so much what's happening now.
Right.
Based on my book, I was invited to give a keynote talk 2 months ago in Boulder at NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Center. They have a yearly space weather meeting. So they actually invited me as a historian to give a pitch on the history of Boulder and space weather. So that was very nice, and I got to see many people who I used to work with from 20, 25, 30 years ago.
Cool. All right, Joe, we will be in touch. I will send you the archived information early in the morning, and I want to thank you for being with us. And listeners, those of you who emailed us in comments and questions, thank you as well. And we'll be in touch with you soon.
Take care, David.
Thank you. And listeners, back again Friday, and Sunday is open lines. Good night, everybody, from Dr. Joe Bassi and The Space Show.